Okay, that's it for the announcements. I want to introduce our speaker today, who's Sarah Garnham. Sarah is one of the members of the National Executive of Socialist Alternative. She's a well-known activist here in Sydney, particularly on university campuses, where she led the campaign against Tony Abbott's $100,000 degrees in 2014. So I want you to make her feel welcome. She's going to speak for a while, and then we'll have time for a discussion and questions to follow after that. So please welcome Sarah.
Okay, cool. Look, suddenly got dark in here. That's all right, it's ambient. The first thing I want to sort of talk about is the fact that nationalism and nationalist consciousness are really prevalent today in our current day and age. And I think that that is a sort of interesting point, given that there's been now decades of globalization, there's been the rise of multinational corporations, production has been spread all across the planet and sort of broken up into different supply chains that definitely cannot be confined to one or just a couple of nations. There's been the development of bodies like the World Trade Organization, of the IMF, all sorts of free trade organizations and so on, and military alliances as well that cross national borders like NATO. But despite all of that, nationalism is not abating. And in fact, there are even more nations today than there ever have been, and this trend is increasing. There's been a massive increase of nations, the creation of nations, in even just the last 40 years. Nationalism does not seem out of step with the realities of modern capitalism to millions of people across the world, despite the globalised nature of the world. In fact, it actually seems more relevant than ever. So we just have to look at things like Trump's support in the US, or the rise of nationalism in Europe, or the kind of constant use of jingoistic nationalism here in Australia by the political class here, as well as things like the rise of, or the revival of One Nation, which, you know, has the name in the title, and so on in Australia. But while nationalism is certainly the catch cry of the far right, it also has many non-right-wing expressions, manifestations. It's often actually an expression of oppression, and in some cases is actively promoted by the left. So, for example, if you look at some of the ways that refugees speak about wanting to come into Australia, or how enthusiastically migrants kind of embrace the idea that they should be part of a multicultural Australia, I think you can see the way it's an expression of oppression and people's attempt to kind of find some remedy to that oppression. So, for example, there was, you know, recently, I think it was last Invasion Day / Australia Day, there was a billboard set up in Melbourne that had an image of Muslim women and a kind of, you know, the slogan of something about Australia Day. And this caused both outrage on the right that how dare these people be used to symbolise the Australian nation, but also a kind of outrage in response by many people in the migrant community that this is actually really important that Muslim people get included in the Australian nation in this representative way. Then there's also different ways in which nationalism pervades or affects the workers' movement. That happens here, but all across the world. So often demands of the union movement get posed in nationalist terms. So things like, you know, Aussie jobs for Aussie workers and so on. Without any of the slogans, just the very demand to keep Australian manufacturing within the territory of Australia and so on. I think this expression of nationalism reflects the defensiveness and the pro-Labor parliamentary kind of orientation of many of the unions. But it also actually just reflects the centrality of a reformist consciousness that is spread throughout the working class. And I think it's no wonder that there are all these contradictions, all these different seemingly kind of jarring iterations of nationalism. Because nationalism is the number one universalising ideology of capitalism. And it's a universalising ideology in a system where there is absolutely no universality. There is no universal interest or perspective under capitalism. It is a system driven by class divisions, but nationalism is the key way of trying to manufacture something of a universal interest. So, of course, because of that, because it sits atop of a society that does not actually represent a universal interest, it is very contradictory. Now, the age of neoliberalism, as I said, has actually intensified, not diminished, nationalism. And I want to look at why that might be the case. Firstly, I think neoliberalism has accelerated capitalism's tendency, so it's already very much an existing tendency, to introduce the market into every single aspect of people's lives, to turn our work into less stable and less meaningful elements of production, and to have us identify primarily as consumers. So you can see that this has, you know, more and more intruded into the way everything is constructed. Even students are more and more presented as consumers rather than students. You know, people who ride public transport are consumers, not passengers. Every single aspect of life is more and more marketized in this way. And this is a profoundly dehumanising and atomising state of affairs. And so I think in that context, nationalism can offer a sense of belonging. It can offer a ready-made kind of historical narrative that is about giving people a sense of social purpose, of community, and of, you know, a sort of basis on which we should be striving to make our country, our community better for the children and so on. And that has replaced or you know, in some ways, partially replaced identities which were much more prevalent in the past. So identities that derive from people having long-term stable jobs, having pride in the sense of camaraderie, of being part of a serious, you know, and militant union membership, having pride and identification with whole areas of civil society that have been disintegrated, like sporting clubs, ethnic associations, churches, all of these things have decreased. And so nationalism as an alternative has increased. And the, of course, this means different things for different groups of people. For people who are legitimately, you know, so-called, entitled to claim a national identity within a country they live, this sense of nationalism offers support. It offers qualification to things like the welfare system, to healthcare, to diplomatic support, all of these kind of things. Gives people a sense that when in a time of crisis, they have some community to fall back on as a safety net. But also it has an important political purpose for the ruling class, which has nothing else to offer in a neoliberal period to, you know, the majority of people throughout society, except for a kind of hostility to foreigners and refugees and those who transgress the rules of the nation, borders, sacred institutions of national capital and so on. So for them, it's become really important in this period as well. I think most importantly for the capitalist class, because we talk a lot about the way that they use nationalism to, you know, promote racism and fear towards different groups of people, refugees and migrants. But I think also, more importantly than that, for the capitalist class, talking about the nation provides a way of talking about capitalism without having to name it. And most of the time they're talking about nationalism, they're talking about capitalism. So if you think about the shenanigans in the Liberal Party room recently, all of it is kind of talked about by them and by the media and so on as, you know, we need to get back to focusing on, you know, the nation, looking after the nation. We need to get back to Parliament so we can pass more bills. We need to, you know, provide stability to the nation and so on. But all of that is actually about we need to get back to focusing on capitalism. And so measures of economic health that are always talked about in terms of this is good for the nation are actually measures of what is good for the capitalist class, which is something that the, you know, ruling class cannot openly admit to. And actually it's in their interest to not draw attention to the social relations that underpin the notion of a nation. Okay, so now I want to move on to talk about how we actually define nation, nationalism, national consciousness and so on, because I think that it's some of these terms are very, very difficult to define. So starting with nations, it is and has always been historically difficult to define exactly what a nation is. There are many criteria lists that have been drawn up by academics and Marxists and economists and so on, but none of them really fit all cases of a nation. So those criteria are usually things like language, cultural reference points, territorial area, structures of government, currency. And all of those things I just listed, I think people in this room could probably think of exceptions to those, you know, places where there's not a singular national currency, all of these kinds of things, language, but they are very much still nations. So it's difficult to come up with a kind of, I think, rigid black and white parameters for what constitutes a nation, because it's a contradictory phenomenon. I think one definition that's useful is one offered by the Marxist Neil Davidson, who says that a nation is a group of people that feel themselves to be collectively distinct from other groups, usually for the accumulated, historical or cultural reasons. So as you can see, that is a very broad definition. And it's a definition that doesn't imply enthusiasm. So people can accept and understand the reality of a nation without necessarily politically supporting it. Or they can just have passive acceptance of it. So, you know, people born into Australia or whatever have to kind of have passive acceptance of the fact that there is a nation. There is this giant, you know, Australian government and state bureaucracies and so on that you're born into and affect your life and control your life and so on. For aspiring nations, I think that the way that people accept or understand the nation is obviously going to be different. It's much more going to be often a more strongly held consciousness, but also one that's related to injustice or oppression. Okay, so to talk about national consciousness, I think we have to say as well that national consciousness is different to the nation and whether or not that, you know, exists. But it's also different to nationalism. And national consciousness can be, you know, one part of consciousness alongside many other things. It's a way of people defining themselves and understanding themselves that can exist alongside class consciousness, along other forms of social consciousness. And for that reason, it can be quite superficial and quite unstable. So you think about World War One, that happens over a few short years. Famously, millions of people actually supported World War One when it first begun on the basis of, you know, a sort of nationalist consciousness and so on. But as they started to realise the reality of that war was, you know, hurting working class people primarily and so on, they turned against it. And you had, you know, one of the most kind of anti-nationalist expressions on a wide scale that we've ever seen. So that is an indication of how these things can, the national consciousness can jar with other social realities. Okay, so as I said, national consciousness is not the same as nationalism. Nationalism is the ideology that is about identification first and foremost with the nation. It's about supporting the nation or the creation of a nation, no matter what the sort of social consequences of that are. And it's the idea that what unites people in a particular nation, in a particular nation, is more important and more fundamental than what divides it. So this applies clearly to the far right's conception of nationalism, but it also does apply to left-wing manifestations of nationalism, such as national liberation struggles, like that of the Palestinians. But it also explains why when these struggles succeed or succeed in some of their aims, problems are set in. So national liberation movements actually cannot satisfy the aspirations of all of the members of a said nation because the ideology of the universalizing kind of common interests that's held by that group is broken apart when class differences rise to the fore. So actually the interests of the ruling class and middle class sections of a oppressed nation will be different to those of the working class, and those can kind of coexist for a time. But when there's actually success and, you know, nationhood is established or something approximating that, those other divisions start to emerge. Okay, so talking now about the ideology of nationalism and the idea of the nation, I think one of the most pervasive aspects of that ideology is that the nation is some sort of timeless, eternal expression that reflects something essential about human differentiation, about, like, you know, different groups of people have been differentiated historically due to cultural reasons and so on. But in fact, nations are a very, very recent phenomenon. They arose in conjunction with and as a consequence of the development of the capitalist mode of production. And this was first established in Europe. So national consciousness did not create capitalist modes of administration in most cases. It wasn't the first thing to happen, but rather it was the other way around. It was the fact that there was there needed to be differentiation between different groups had to be destroyed, and unification of kind of different social structures needed to be created. So, for example, in Europe, in the year 1500, there were about 500 independent political units. So not nations, but, you know, groups of people who define themselves as a community, as a kind of political community. Within a couple of hundred years, that had been reduced to just 25 units. And this was this traces the development of the consolidation of modern nation states. And the reason this happened is that there were a whole series of changes that were going on under and within pre-capitalist forms of the state that basically laid the basis for what we now know as the modern state and laid the basis for the destruction of the old feudal or absolute states. So some of the things that were going on. Firstly, there had to be increasingly a demarcation of economic activity. Not so much to fit with the new kind of emerging capitalist mode of production, but to fit with its attendant trade needs. So the fact that you needed to have, and you had an expansion of trade and so on, pushed in the direction of linking dispersed or culturally divergent groups together into trade communities. And this led, as Benedict Anderson talks about quite a lot, to the necessity for a certain language as a kind of administrative tool to manage these trade communities. So establishing a common language, which is something that had not existed prior to that, was born out of that. This also started to create informal boundaries of economic activity, which didn't coincide with those of the feudal states. So then you had to start to come up against the problems of the feudal states actually saying, you know, this is our territory, this is our political unit, and it not corresponding with these new borders of trade economies. Another development that sort of began to entrench this was the development of large-scale printing, and the fact that this was a product of the development of the mode of production of early capitalism, but also basically created a need for more and more people to be able to engage with a common language to then, you know, read the press, read the materials and so on. And then those publications then themselves were instrumental in actually trying to create a kind of nationalist consciousness and so on, because once you have a kind of common news cycle or press distribution, it's about saying to people, you know, it somehow matters to you that some event that happened in Melbourne this morning on the train system that gets reported to you in the, you know, 6 p.m. news bulletin, that somehow relates to you because, you know, you're part of this community. So even though that didn't affect your life at all, you hear about it in, you know, the Australian press, and it's like this is this common thing that's happened to all Australians and so on. So that kind of stuff, you know, in a very primitive form began to happen. As well, there was the changing nature of feudal states. So gradually concentrating state power centrally and leading in the direction of standing armies. Standing armies became necessary for these newly emerging capitalist states because they needed to defend themselves, but also they were using more and more trying to create more and more definition for the state in order to do things like centralised taxation. And then, as this started to happen, That led to rivalry between the sort of new proto-states and so on, which in turn increased the need to strengthen the standing army, the military prowess of particular states. So all of these things happened because the bourgeoisie started to emerge, but also they aided in the development of the bourgeoisie in these societies. And they could provide important support in terms of financing and administration to the feudal rulers as well. So it wasn't as if all of these new developments just completely were a massive assault on the direction that the feudal rulers were taking things in necessarily. Actually, in many cases, developing these more kind of defined state structures and so on were advantageous in the short term, but in the end, they were part of the gradual shift towards the replacement of these states by new capitalist forms of state. Another factor was the Reformation, which I won't go into particularly, but basically you had, like, the Reformation challenged the idea that people's identity should be with the Holy Roman Empire or the Catholic Church across multiple territories, and saw the consolidation of things like the German state and, you know, other European states and so on. Okay, so none of these things that I've described, and there are other factors as well, were automatic, and that's something I want to convey, that this all happened in a kind of contradictory way. It did not proceed just smoothly and was not just directed by the interests of the rising capitalist class. Rather, there were battles between the old order and the new, and between different players in order to establish what kind of nation states would come to dominate. Okay, so looking then at the establishment of the nation versus the kind of later thing, which is the establishment of more widespread national consciousness. So while the first capitalist states were clearly a product of the changing economic conditions of society and the similarly changing concerns of society's rulers, the ideology of the nation actually came a fair bit later. So for newer nations, interestingly, the ideology of nationalism, of national of the nation state and so on, actually tended to come earlier. So some of the oldest European states were later to develop a really firm kind of sense of nationalism. The reason that they developed more rapidly, nationalism developed more rapidly in national consciousness, and the national ideology, more rapidly in newer nations, was because it was really used as a primary kind of motivator for building up these new nations and making them viable in terms of rivaling other ones, but also just logistically administrating them and so on. Okay, so nation today is established as very much a fundamental kind of building block of the world order. And I think that once nations had been created and a tenant national ideology, nationalism has since then been one of the key prisms through which the demands of many sections of society are expressed. One of the things I want to talk about is the demands of the oppressed are often expressed through this prism. So oppressed minorities articulating their demands for national autonomy or control of a nation state. And this happens not only when there is a clear claim to a nation with territorial cohesion, but it happens for many oppressed groups who are denied any political rights at all. So you have things like the Kurds and so on, where even though the kind of historic claim to historic Kurdistan seems more and more like a something that will not be a reality, that the Kurdish people still demand national rights and so on. The Palestinians, the Macedonians, lots of different groups of people whose areas are occupied by imperial powers and who are excluded from any political rights as a result. I think that even going further than that, that for national consciousness or something approximating it to develop, there doesn't even need to be any of the kind of things that rigidly define a nation. So there doesn't even need to be once there was a historical territory or anything like that. I think black people in America, but also Aboriginal people here in Australia, A lot of the way I think we should understand how they define themselves and what their consciousness consists of is nationalist consciousness. And that has been developed in response to the racial oppression that they've been subjected to by various administrations. So Aboriginal people, for example, in this country, many of the nations that make up the kind of the idea of the Aboriginal nation, they never saw themselves as a joined kind of block prior to white invasion and genocide and so on. And also, even within all of the different nations, there have actually been some new ones created since invasion. So actually national kind of version of national consciousness is used to express the kind of the shared oppression that Aboriginal people face because of, you know, racism. And it's expressed in demands and terms that are very similar to, you know, groups like the Palestinians or so on. Okay, so I think that, just to finish, I want to say that I think that any idea that capitalism could exist today without nationalism is fairly ludicrous. I think that the capitalist class is ever more dependent on the nation state, and this is a debate that happened, has happened over the last 20 or 30 years in various ways in response to the things I started with, the rise of globalisation and multinational capital and so on. People have started to question whether or not the state still plays a key role in society or whether it was part of the kind of phase of primitive, like early development of capitalism and is fading away. I think the state in no way is fading away. I think the 2008 bailouts of the banks was a real proof of that, just in empirical terms, how much the state is prepared to step in to save its national capital. But also the constant arming of different nation states so that they can express and project their military power across the world to secure interests of particular national groups of the bourgeoisie is something that is more prevalent than ever. But I think it's also worth saying that aspects of nationalism and the state, the construction of states, can work sometimes against the kind of raw economic interests of the capitalist class. And we shouldn't see that the interests of the capitalist class can just unilaterally be imposed upon society. One of the ways they do impose them is through things like the nation state. But once you have a nation state, that carries with it contradictions and so on. So, for example, some of the protectionist policies being advanced in the interests of nationalism and so on are against the interests of core sections of the capitalist class. Also, some elements, not all of them, but of the far right, who really rest on nationalism as a way of, growing themselves as a movement and so on, are actually disconnected to quite a large degree from the direct interests of the bourgeoisie. So I think understanding that both the nation state and nationalism is a key tool of the capitalist class, but also is a contradictory phenomenon, is an important way to balance that. And I think that precisely because it's not this mechanical expression of the bourgeois interests in, you know, every instance, that means that the tensions and contradictions created by nations and nationalisms can be a basis for sparks of rebellion and for struggle across the world. And, you know, we continue to see that. But I think that, we shouldn't think that is at all going to go away.
Thank you.